The SGGQA podcast is brought to you in part by Me Audio. So here's the deal. If you've ever seen me in a live stream or in an interview or some other kind of video, you've probably seen me wearing some fancy earbuds. For the last couple years, my work buds have been almost exclusively from Me Audio. Excellent drivers, fantastic accessories, and both my wife and I had our ears scanned by the folks at Me Audio for custom molded ear tips. Super comfy. The MX line of Pro in-ear monitors is one of the easiest lineups to understand, starting at $60 and built around actual professional use. Detailed sound and durable construction, but also with some fun options like customizable faceplates. Even if you're not working on stage or in studio, Pro solutions like these are fantastic audio options, and they don't need to break the bank. And the company also supports a lineup of consumer gear with options for true wireless and noise-canceling Bluetooth earbuds, adapters for TVs to stream your audio to nicer headphones, and headsets for kids to help control the volume on fresh, developing ears. I can't stress that last one enough. We have to start kids out with healthier listening habits. It's a great combo, high-quality audio gear built by a team of folks with recording-grade use in mind, but at consumer-friendly prices. But of course, I can do you one better. If you shop the kit at meaudio.com and use promo code SOMEGADGETGUY at checkout, you can save an additional 10% over their already competitive prices. Once again, meaudio.com, M-E-E-audio.com. Shop some fun kit, promo code SOMEGADGETGUY at checkout, 10% off. Keep your ears and your wallet happy at the same time. I want to thank the folks at Me Audio for hooking up the promo code. Now, let's get on with the show. All right. I believe this means we are live. Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, tech fans of all shapes and sorts and sizes and persuasions, welcome to another episode of the Monday Morning Tech Chat Show on the SGGQA podcast channel. I'm Juan Carlos Bagnell, some gadget guy, the SGG of this horribly, horribly named podcast series. And of course, the QA is the important part, the question and answer, as we like to make this an interactive conversation, chat out some of the news, some of the headlines that have been floating through the tech community, really get a feel for what it is that we're dealing with in the world of tech, sort out our feels, and give these stories time to mature so it's not just going from headline to headline, but following up on some of the trends that we see in the tech community. And Grill's already telling me to stretch. I feel like we need to start doing like an over-under on what hat I'm going to wear. So we can make that like informal poll at the beginning of every live chat. I'm already seeing a great group in here in the chat room. Matt Tyler, Squishy, Osran, Rue Sunshine, Dave Burns, Awesome Possum, Grillinkitus, Bowang Bite, Chatty Boy. I'm missing someone. Al Spockley, Vazicose, Lanny. We got a show. Aussie Beach Bum. Hey, what's up from down under? And Doom Mer saying hello. All right. I am woefully underslept. Okay. Just to start off the show. First of all, I hope you had a wonderful Super Bowl weekend. If you're of the persuasion to watch American style football, which is kind of, what do we want to call it? It's like, you know, rugby with safe pads. Is that what we're calling American football? I was way out of touch this season. I was not keeping up. I always love, especially from the Reddit, Superb Owl, because of all of the legal shenanigans that you can get into catching Super Bowl being such a delicately protected copyright. Safe pads and more stoppages, LOL, from Osran. We tuned in for a while, and then the Bucks started trouncing the Chiefs, and we didn't really have any strong feelings about either team. My wife is kind of just of the mindset. Maria's her the extent of her football fandom, or I guess I should say, just her football interest is anything anti-Tom Brady. She is, so if Tom Brady's playing, then she will root for the team that does not have Tom Brady. And then beyond that, she really doesn't care. We're kind of more of a soccer and baseball family in this household. So, you know, when the Red Sox and the Dodgers were in the World Series, you know, that was really testing the limits of our marriage, because, you know, we had our AL and NL teams, and I really like the Dodgers, but I love the Red Sox, and my wife, vice versa. So, I mean, that's kind of our sports ball right there. But yeah, there were some fun commercials, and it was an excuse to kind of eat some snacks. It just really did kind of drive home. The Super Bowl has always been a time for us to get together with friends. We do a chili cook-off where I do up a green chili stew. Another one of my friends will do up another kind of New Mexican, maybe like a pozole. And then another friend of ours will do a Texan-style chili. And every year we try out new recipes. And it's really just an excuse to break out the crock pots and like eat way too much food with a whole grip of our friends. And I was really grateful that this year our friends kind of slow played it. We weren't, we didn't do any kind of get together. Kind of put that on hold until we could all get vaccinated. And then we're going to do a catch up. We're going to do another chili cook-off, maybe, you know, maybe in time for Thanksgiving if we can all get vaccinated. But after the Super Bowl, my wife and I, we went for a walk around the neighborhood, and it was really telling. Like, to one side of us is an apartment complex, and that looked totally dead. To the other side of us are a bunch of like way overpriced townhouse units. So, you know, on one side, renters, on the other side, probably a lot of people leasing, but more homeowners in a slightly more upscale. I can't tell you the number of block parties that were happening. The roads totally full of extra cars. People, like, you could hear people in homes like celebrating, and it was just such a difficult moment to get through, as Marie and I have been so strict in sheltering and you know, sort of agonizing about what to do with Lex and school and Marie and her job and me and studio work, and then just to like, oh, it's a Super Bowl, we still have to get together and eat cheese dip. It was pretty frustrating. Gary the Fireman got a bucket of Popeyes. I feel like that is a great celebration right there. I have not had Popeyes in a while. I do not know if there is a Popeyes near me. I could totally go for some spicy chicken. Some chicken with some bite. So, DTNL food coma? Yes, please. I made up a Texan style chili this year. I need to get a good cornbread recipe, because I've just been using mixes and they come out okay. Or at least I need to figure out how to doctor up a good cornbread mix. Never been a fan. You go through the recipe and it's like, well, add a can of corn if you want and more flavor. And you're like, what? That's not a... I need a proper cornbread recipe. So I'm going to work on that this time next year. I'll have demoed some cornbread recipes, and I feel like my channel will just be a cooking channel. You know, we'll give up on all this consumer tech, because as we're going to be talking about as in part of this podcast in the second half, new phones, informal poll, worth it? Yay or nay? And I want to hear from you. Let's see. Dank Pikmin God, did you see the whole Samsung India controversy on our Android? I do not frequent our Android, and especially because a lot of the folks at our Android really don't like me, so I don't go digging for news there. So if someone has a link, shoot me a link if there's some crazy Samsung thing that we should try and staple onto this show. Squishy Man, your Die Hard video is a bit of a slide away from phones. The Die Hard video was in keeping with how I started producing online content, with a little old show called Movies You May Have Missed, where me and a buddy would sit in his absolutely filthy bachelor pad and Dig Nation style, two douchebags on a couch, talk about movies. I still keep flirting with trying to find a way to bring that back, but man, movie commentary on the internet isn't as fun as it used to be. Oh, yeah. Sorry, Boing Byte, because of moderation issues, you can't drop a link there. But hit me up on some other platform real quick, and we'll see if we can we can dig up that story. So, let me get this out of the way here. Oh, and also I just kind of wanted to show this off because I thought it was kind of cute. I don't know if I'll keep it, but I'm a big fan of my Weyland Yutani cap. This is a ball cap. This is the corporation from the movie Alien and Aliens. I'm trying to wear it out. Like, I'm trying to make it look as old and as worn and as rough around the edges as like an actual movie prop might be. But my buddy Andrew, Fat Produce, often in the comments, I don't think he's here right now, sent me a little sticker with the Weyland Yutani logo, and it took me way too long to kind of grok that, like, there's a square of the Windows logo on my Surface Duo, so I put the Weyland Yutani logo on the other side, and so it's a little bit puffy. It's a sticker that's got like a little bit of depth to it, so if I just put the Surface down, it kind of wobbles on the tabletop. So I might not keep that, or maybe I'll throw on the bumper. I've never attached the Surface bumper, but I just really like that there's square on one side and square on the other side, and now I have a Weyland Yutani portable data communication device, and that makes me nerdy Twitter pated. So, Matt Tyler saying he loves this hat because those are great movies, and he is correct. They are phenomenal, phenomenal, phenomenal films. DT, no, I am not opposed to the idea of Juan cooking food with his regular snarkiness. Well, if I could do anything anywhere near the scientific, Mr. Wizard value of Alton Brown, I feel like I would be doing amazing good work. So, let's get into some housekeeping. We're 9:10 in the AM, and you know what we haven't done for a while is an over under on how long we get through housekeeping. So drop some estimates. Let's see how quickly I can clear this, because we had quite a bit of stuff go out over this last week. It was a kind of a roller coaster ride of a week, and I got some fun audio gear out. Again, I'm trying to more regularly work audio, not just audio reviews, but then also getting back to some of my 2020 hearing videos and some stuff like that. Dave Burns is saying 35 minutes. All right, as long as I come in under 35 minutes, just so I can kick David's butt, then I'm good. Let's see. Gabaletta saying 17, Boang Bite saying 22, Gary the Fireman giving me a perfectly reasonable 14 minutes, Matt Tyler 12 minutes and 14.5 seconds, Rue Sunshine saying 12, Awesome Possum's just saying drag it out. He loves the housekeeping. All right, let's dig in. All of the stories that we're going to be talking about, all of the articles, all of the news links, and of course, all of the housekeeping can be found on the show notes for this episode on somegadgetguy.com. All right. Let me cue this up here. I'm not going back 2 weeks because last week we had a very informal podcast. So this is just over the last week. A number one, the One More Comfo Buds. Comfy communicator earbuds. One More is a brand that I very much enjoy covering in the consumer electronics, consumer audio space. I think they've done a very good job of carving out a popular niche of premium audio at competitive prices. And while they're catching up on some of the techier features, I really do like the focus they've put on audio quality. The Comfo Buds are a slightly different conversation than some of their hardcore active noise canceling or sport earbuds. These are more AirPod style, but they've got this cute little grommet sort of rubber tip that's added to the end of the earbud that's supposed to make them a little comfier. And I got a full look, a full review on what it was like wearing those and then taking them out into the real world outside of the gadget lab. Following up on that was probably the heaviest hitting video I've put out for a while. And this video is titled "Tech Reviewers Are Scum." And then I've been messing around with the title. So sometimes it's Reddit Weighs In or Reddit Smackdown. But in starting off 2021, I feel a lot of us are catching a vibe. some of my buddies in the tech review space, like Jason over at Painfully Honest Tech, has been talking about what kind of changes he wants to bring to his channel. I've been following channels like Mr. Tech Rant, you know, again, a consumer advocacy conversation as opposed to just always highlighting the press release of a review and then shooting fancy B-roll. We can talk about the actual consumer impact of using some of these gadgets and the price performance and the value for money. So those conversations I've really been valuing. Zach Talks Tech, again, another great voice in our tech sort of commentary ecosystem, trying to change up some of his review process, where he's not going to be flipping phones as aggressively. He's going to try and focus in on what it's like to use this one device. I think is he focusing on an S21 Ultra? I can't remember. So it started out as a joke. Someone shared it on the Discord, this Reddit YouTube tech reviewer starter pack. If you've ever been to starter packs, there are these meme jokes that you kind of boil down a community into their most popular tropes. And so we all had a good laugh at my expense, because I definitely resemble some of those comments or some of those tropey jokes in this image. They mentioned they got it from a Reddit. So I go to the Reddit and hundreds of comments. This starter pack. Starter packs don't typically blow up on the front page, and techie stuff typically doesn't blow up on the front page. And so I'm reading through these comments, and man, like, they are skewering every bad trope, from shocked dopey thumbnails to dumb questions in the video. So tell me what you think. I've told you all the specs of this phone. Drop a comment. Do you like this phone? Thumbs up this video and smash that bell icon. You know, like, the comment, if you're into tech, and especially if you follow like a core group of tech reviewers, these comments are brutal. So I made a video kind of talking about that, kind of my experiences reading through the comments, the subreddit, and then also some of the trends that I think are actually pretty problematic. So my clickbaity title, the second part of this, is what we're going to be talking about later on in the second half of this podcast. Are new phones worth it? Because I feel like a lot of consumers aren't seeing it. And I don't think techies are doing a good job of highlighting what makes a new phone interesting to talk about. Instead, it's the new phone, so we have to talk about it. And I feel like that's the obligation of watering down a market, eliminating competition. And then why would we care? So, yeah, I had a lot of fun with that, even though most of that fun was at my expense. Nifty Mittens giving away some subs. Nifty Mittens, thank you so much. That is such a wonderful way to support, and I very much appreciate you tagging some of these people, like TK Bay, Rami, Tay, Nintendo Switch, 0303 2017, Drew. That's greatly appreciated, and especially for your first time watching live, I really do appreciate the support. Alice Bockley, I hate that with a passion. Clickbait title, expecting a juicy commentary. Instead, I get a recital of the specs and, so what do you think? Gary the Fireman, Nifty Mittens, we can trust JCB. Hop train! So, getting back to some housekeeping, I got the Comfo Buds out. The Comfo Buds, those little earbuds, and AirPod-style earbuds are open ear. I'm not the biggest fan, especially personally, and this is sharing my bias and my preferences, I'm not the biggest fan of open ear earbuds because they do a terrible job of blocking the world around you, and then they're also right in front of your ear canal. So they're not super great for situational awareness, right? You'll hear that claim a lot, like, oh, well, I like my AirPods because I can still hear what's going on around me, except for all of the people that then just jack the volume and listen way too loud so they can block out the world around them. So I was super stoked to get a new pair of Aftershocks in-house. And this one's got a slightly different focus. Aftershocks has a rep for lots of sport style bone conduction headphones. So there's a little pad that rests on your cheekbone right in front of your ear, And they're built more for like people who work out or exercise outdoors. So this is their first take on a more office or productivity focused headset. And so they take their new ear pads from the AeroPex, which are phenomenal upgrades. Again, every generation of Aftershocks, they've tweaked or refined something that I didn't think bone conduction could improve on. And the listening experience on bone conduction now is unrecognizable from the very first pair of Aftershocks that I ever tried. And I still like what those original cabled Aftershocks used to offer. But OpenCom now brings those new ear pads, better audio fidelity, better, especially better articulation. So it's not just kind of a tactile vibration against the side of your face. It is an improved audio experience with a cute little boom mic. So a little swivel mic that kind of focuses in on your voice a little bit more. I did a microphone sample of not just recording off that voice, but I uploaded a private stream to YouTube from OBS and then pulled that video back down. And it's hilarious because you can see how absolutely awful the webcam is on my laptop. But it sounds pretty good. I mean, I think it sounds really good for a Bluetooth solution like this. And again, it's more about reducing noise and other distracting elements. So the fidelity on my voice isn't great, but having that little bit of an extra positionable microphone, I think, was a cute benefit. So if you really do care about hearing health, being able to hear what's going on around you, and you want to dig on something that's a little futuristic feeling, I still feel like bone conduction still feels like magic, where your ears are totally open and you can hear what's going on. And then there's this audio that can kind of just float through the world with you. And then when you want to focus, you can throw in some earplugs and the audio actually improves in quality. So like now your ears are totally blocked and the audio got better. It's so hard to kind of convey that experience just in words, but I really like Aftershocks are the gold standard of that kind of experience. And then, oh, Gary the Fireman just gifted a sub too. Sub to Vazikos. Man, I really appreciate, and a sub to Rue Sunshine. Well, thank you so much. I definitely appreciate that, man. Gary, you've always had my back, and I definitely appreciate that. So wrapping up housekeeping. I got distracted because Gary and Nifty are super awesome people, and I owe them a libation of some sort. For a while, we've been trying to hunt out a new phone for Marie. And she was using an LG G7. She really liked her G7, but it was starting to get a little old. She is super rough on gadgets, and the G7 had taken some really bad knocks and was cracked, and just needed to kind of replace it. From the launch of the Pixel 4a, we had been talking about what to get her. And there were always these sort of frustrating compromises that she would need to make. She doesn't want to give up on a headphone jack. She would have preferred the smallest possible form factor phone. Now, this is a woman that started her smartphone computing journey on a BlackBerry Curve. And I bet you there's a part of her where if she could get a BlackBerry Curve with modern guts, she would go back. So the Team Pixel folks sent over a Pixel 4a 5G, and I kind of hit them up and said, like, I reviewed the Pixel 4a and I reviewed the Pixel 5. I totally appreciate you hooking us up with a phone, but I'm probably not going to run a lot of personal coverage on it. Would you mind if we used it as Marie's phone and we could share her thoughts? So she's been using it for almost 2 months now, and she's not really super into doing a whole bunch of on-camera stuff, but, you know, we really wanted to kind of talk out what her experiences were. I've been super hands-off. I mean, like, I helped her set up the phone, and then I walked away. And these are her experiences in using this phone. And she, I mean, my wife is savvy. She's articulate. She never credits herself with knowing as much about tech as she really does, but she's not into tech as entertainment. She doesn't really care about what the gadget is, so long as she has access to the entertaining things on that gadget that she cares about. So it's an hour-long conversation, and we in being an old fuddy-duddy married couple, we decided to kind of lubricate that conversation with some tasty bourbon. And I feel like it was a really fun conversation to put together to give a slightly different take on what it's like using this stuff and also what she got most excited about. I think one of the things that got her the most excited about this and future phone challenges was the idea that if we can keep her at the same general computing level, she's not interested in a more powerful phone or crazy better cameras or any of these things. She's actually interested to see if she can plateau, and then every time we replace her phone from here on, we can spend less. So we've got like a fun challenge for ourselves at the end of that podcast. So we'll see how that goes. But the conversation, again, I think my wife is totes adorbs, and I feel for all of us tech reviewers who try to talk about the average general consumer experience. We don't hear very often from actual average general consumers. So I'm going to try and add in a little bit more of that when I can. Dave Bonine, I hope you guys are able to investigate the gravitational anomalies trailing Marie. Rue Sunshine, waiting to see how many scratches does the 4A 5G survive in her purse. My wife's purse is where gadgets go to die. But I mean, that also contributed. We were looking at a Pixel. We were looking at the Pixel 4A, the Pixel 5. We were also looking at the LG Velvet because she really did like her G7. But, you know, size considerations, materials, you know, case options. I mean, so much factored into that where the different pros and cons kind of led us in one direction. And she still had to kind of compromise on some of the things that she wanted to go with the Pixel. But it's been interesting watching her use this phone where she's technically gone down a tier. You know, if you pick up an LG G7, that's still a powerhouse device. And it's still more powerful than a current mid-ranger Pixel, even the Pixel 5, the Snapdragon 845 versus 765, blah, 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 blah. Does that matter? Because I could say for my wife, it doesn't seem to have mattered much to her making that humongous compromise of not having the absolute bestest, most powerfulest phone in a premium shell. So again, just a way for us to check in and a way for us to have a conversation that's not just reading off the spec sheet from GSM Arena. Doomer with a highlighted comment. I use plastic earphones for casual YouTube watching or online school meetings or even games because I don't want isolation when I want to hear stuff around me indoors. Otherwise, I use earphones with good isolation for music and even when outside because the JBL neckband I have has a talk-through mode where I can hear everything almost as if I didn't have my ears plugged. The only thing I'm going to add to that, and I think that's a great division. I am a big fan of owning different earbud and headphone solutions for different conditions. I do not believe in a one-size-fits-all, and I don't think you should need to break the bank on one nice pair of headphones that you try to use for everything. I think that's a bad way to spend your money. I think having a couple options so that you can make sure you've got the right tool for the right location, absolutely the way to go. The only thing I would add is even when we think we want open ear, we have a tendency to turn up the volume louder than we need to. So when you're using those sort of casual, lazy, open ear earbuds, set a volume limit. And if your phone can put a hard limit, so you physically cannot turn it up louder, there's a tendency behaviorally for us to kind of juice up the audio when there's some kind of competing noise in our environment. We think we're being really rational about this kind of stuff. We're really not good at it as a species. So I'd just add that, especially if you're like on an iPhone, use that volume limiter tool. I really wish Android had a hard limit for volume just like iOS does. But some manufacturers will build that in. Others just throw that nag screen. It's not that. You want to listen in a quiet environment at a very comfortable level, and then you set that as your peak. And I guarantee you, when you go out and you try and use AirPods, you know, not AirPods Pro or in-ear, but if you use any kind of open earbud, you're going to find right away that your comfortable listening volume is horrifically insufficient as soon as there's even the tiniest bit of noise competing for your attention. And that's when we just, oh, well, I'll just turn it up a little right now. And then your ear starts to get numb because you're just hammering your eardrum. You're just hammering your ear with way more force than you need. So, Gary the fireman, you should really marry her. I'm really glad I married her. I think my wife is super good people. from Heike, your gadget taste is the same with your wife, so you're a perfect gadget match. Reference to one specific YouTube channel. What's fun is my wife likes some similar tech for very different reasons than I do. So we get along, but we do have very different needs and considerations for what we like and what we need. You should review your wife on YouTube. I'll review her right now. 10 out of 10, best decision I ever made. Super awesome, good people. And my wife probably represents one of the strongest and most, she exemplifies the most fortitude I think I've ever met in another person. So I'm with good people, and I think I did real well. Mick Corcoran 3. So you guys like having wives? Drop a comment down below. Leave me a comment. That's a ghost biased review. I'm going to tap out of this now. We should probably wrap up housekeeping. With my little extended mix on housekeeping, we're just under 20 minutes. Okay. I feel like getting back on track and looking at the time, we're doing all right. Why don't we knock out some news? Let's chew through some news, and then we can get into the gadget block. And I really do. I really want to have a conversation at the end of the podcast looking at the worth itness and the value of phones, especially in light of 2021 handsets coming out and kind of feeling a bit underwhelming. So jumping into the news block, like I said, all links, stories, housekeeping, somegadgetguy.com. You can catch all the show notes when the audio version goes live. How many people in this live chat are feeling the idea of driving a car with an Apple logo on it? I will put myself up first that I'm not feeling super positive on the idea of an Apple car. In many of the same ways that I'm politically not a huge fan of Apple business practices. Chatty Boy saying no thank you. Gabaletta also very polite, no thank you. Heike saying nope. Al Spockley saying no, it would just be too weird. Squishy Man, will it have windows? Again, I still feel like the IT crowd has one of my favorite riffs on that tired old joke. Do I work on Macs? No, I mostly do Windows. Matt Tyler saying, I'll not drive an Apple car, but that Sony car, maybe. So it's been one of these on again, off again, rumor mill trends. And we know Apple is talking to automobile manufacturers. We know they've got relationships because of the way that they try to integrate services with like the entertainment setups in a lot of automobiles. But we've been seeing sort of a more aggressive push on this commentary that Apple is directly reaching out to certain automobile manufacturers. But one of the main pieces of news that we got over this last week, see, I started getting a little snarky about Apple, and then they just sniped my stream. Ah, it's the worst. Anyway, game on. So Apple was in talks with a couple different automobile manufacturers, and we just got confirmation that they're not going with Hyundai or Kia. So Korean automobile manufacturers say that this is not happening. This story coming by way of Sohee Kim and Kyunhee Park. I apologize if I mispronounced that name. By way of Bloomberg. Hyundai Motor Company and its affiliate, Kia Motor Corp, said that they aren't in talks with Apple Inc. to develop an autonomous vehicle, responding to intense speculation about the potential new product by the maker of the iPhone. Apple paused discussions with Hyundai and Kia weeks ago about building an electric vehicle. People familiar with the matter told Bloomberg late last week. The Cupertino, California-based company has discussed similar plans with other auto manufacturers. The people added, asking not to be identified because this information isn't public. So, I feel if I were an automobile manufacturer like Hyundai or Kia, I mean, basically any company that builds cars, I would be extremely nervous. Just like super on guard about any potential relationship with a company like Apple. I feel like if Hyundai made an Apple car, all of the headlines would point to Hyundai now just being an Apple accessories manufacturer. Apple car would get all of these headlines, would get all of this attention, would get all of this press, and Hyundai would kind of be shoved aside. And I feel like the hype machine for anything Apple would completely overshadow strategic partnerships with an automobile manufacturer. Apple would get tremendous insight and resources into building an electric vehicle. And then at some point, they'd probably decide to bounce out. You know, you can kind of see it in other relationships, too, where Apple had this tight relationship with IBM, and then Intel started offering some better mobile performance parts. And then when Intel wasn't able to deliver exactly what Apple needed, they were kind of rolling their own. And again, they learned a lot with their partnerships with IBM and with Intel to then develop their own kit. In not a dissimilar way from Tesla getting into the EV market with a strategic partnership with Lotus to design the frame around the original Roadster. I don't know that I'd want Apple involved in a manufacturing segment like automobile. Like if I were running a car company, I don't think I'd want Apple digging through all of my proprietary manufacturing data, because I feel at some point they just bounce with all that info. And then my company would derive almost no benefit from that partnership. We sold units and Apple paid us to make these cars, but now we've basically given customers away to Apple. So we know that the trend is going to be EVs. General Motors, was it General Motors or was it Ford? I can't remember now, but Ford was showing off an EV. I think GM was talking about a whole slate of EVs that are set to come over the next 4 years. We already know that this is the market trend, and Apple getting into this game by using someone else's manufacturing seems to me like it's only going to serve Apple's interests. It's only going to benefit Apple. And then the company that falls for this is going to get raked when Apple decides to go it alone. So, we got the chat back online. Hey folks, are you getting bored of the current collection of tech and geek commentary on the internet? Is the discussion of new electronics feeling a bit stale? Do you want to find some fresh voices to add to your subscription queue? Check out the community on rglowingrectangles on Reddit. Now, this subreddit was built to help new voices in the tech community find more audience, and we need your support. Sharing, commenting, and those precious, tasty upvotes. Reddit can radically help a content creator expand their reach. Do you know a producer who deserves more attention? Do you just want to find fun new stuff? Head on over to reddit.com/r/glowingrectangles and share or browse to your heart's content. Once again, reddit.com/r/glowingrectangles, and let's build something cool together. Chatty boy, Apple did not like that you were bad-mouthing them. I'm going to say, like, hey, any free advice for an automobile manufacturer out there? I don't see how this can in any way be a good long-term goal for you. Warhead Hyundai would make bank. You know, I don't think they would. Again, if Hyundai is building it, that means their customer is Apple. So, I mean, I really want you to think, whenever a company does business with Apple, Apple is just cutthroat, right? So you're going to build at like impossibly slim margins with the highest, you know, QA expectations on delivery. And that doesn't sound like a winning formula. Again, it's kind of like the relationship between a smartphone manufacturer, a carrier, and a consumer. You know, if Hyundai makes this car for Apple, they aren't going to get to set pricing. They aren't going to have a direct relationship with the consumer to sell and to profit, but they will be responsible for distribution, for all of the back end support. You know, oh, take your car to a Hyundai dealership to get support. You know, but if you got Apple Care, we're going to cut you a great deal on your Apple car. I don't see any. I don't see any win for an automobile manufacturer, for someone to really come out ahead doing business with Apple this way. Well, I mean, I know a lot of people are saying, oh, you've got to pay extra for all these accessories, but I really feel like, you know, even just a headphone dongle, you know, there'll be a little lightning connector in the car that you can plug in your iPhone headphone dongle. That's probably the way they'll go. Kia and Hyundai out of the talks to build the Apple car. I feel that's a better, I feel like that's better for them. Hyundai is already trying to build up a brand for EVs under the Ioniq label. Let Apple figure out their own car stuff. You don't need to give Apple any help in disrupting your own market and your relationship with your own consumers. So moving right along. From Hakey, and those cars would be on the MFI program. Every car charger would profit Apple $3. Oh, man, that's hilarious. And Gabaletta, it's kind of like what Apple does when manufacturing goes wrong. They just blame Foxconn. Again, the buck does not stop with Apple for stuff like that. All right, moving right along. We've tagged Apple for some silliness here. We should probably tag Google. And this one was actually talked up pretty hard on the Discord. I'm sure this is going to be very upsetting. I've got, you know, sort of about 40 people kind of live streaming here after the stream borked. But I know all 40 of you are going to be very upset about the future developments at Google for Stadia. This is direct from AP News, written up by May Anderson. Google shutters internal Stadia game studio. Google launched Stadia in November 2019 as a new type of video game platform, blah, blah, blah. But in a Monday blog post, Google said it will no longer invest in creating its own games for the service beyond any near-term planned titles. Jade Raymond, who headed up Stadia Games and Entertainment, is leaving the company. Google did not disclose a total number of job cuts, but said most of the staff in the game development division will be moved to other roles. So at least, I mean, hopefully, if folks were if folks were working at Google for game development, I'm hoping that Google is going to place them on other cool projects. Knowing a lot of people who work in video game development, I would be like unrecoverably upset if I made the choice to leave a game development position at another studio, go to Google, and then before any major titles had even shipped, find out that this division was getting cut. And it's another, unfortunately, it's another solid piece of evidence. Like, man, maybe don't trust Google until a project has reached enough of a user base that Google can't kill it. Because you'd have to be ridiculous. You'd have to be almost certifiable to look at the video game development landscape, throw resources into creating a game studio, and then kill the studio about a year later. Like, game development is years-long cycles to get quality products and learn the trade and the craft of making fun games. Like, who at Google thought that this was going to be like, you know, oh, well, in 6 months, we'll put out all these awesome games and people will want to be on Stadia. Like, that person needs to have their head examined, let alone needs to be removed from any decision making roles at a company like Google. So Stadia is going to shift to being more of a distribution house. I know, like, see, this is what's frustrating about like tech reviewers and tech commentary is we instantly want to go to the most salacious and sort of the farthest end interpretation of a situation. So like the LG memo comes out that they're, of course, examining whether or not they're going to keep their smartphone business around. So the tech reviewer blog post title is LG fails at smartphones, going to leave the smartphone industry. That's not what the story is. The story was a leaked memo is kind of pointing out the super obvious conversations that are happening behind closed doors. And same thing here. It's like, well, we're going to shutter the studio, but that doesn't necessarily mean that Stadia is going to go up in smoke tomorrow. Like the headlines that are extrapolating closing down game development and conflating that with Stadia as a distribution platform. You know, I feel like Google got into this backwards. Like they proved the tech. Like they did probably the best proof of concept for game streaming and then thought, well, hey, every other online store has some kind of in-house development or some kind of process for making games. You can look at Epic Games. We can look at Steam and, you know, Valve. And even, you know, silly things like, what is it, Humble Bundle has their own sort of their own sort of development for supporting indie developers for you to buy cool games at lower prices. And I feel like Google was looking at that going, well, hey, if we're going to have the store, we should make things to put in the store. And you can't just do that. You need to invest, or you need to buy up a studio, or you need to, like, you know, really court indie developers. Like, you need to do something. It took Microsoft a really long time to buy up a bunch of game developers, and what they currently have, I can't even do the count in my head. Someone tell me, Microsoft is currently at what, 12 in-house game devs? 12 studios? Is that what we're at? Including Microsoft Studios Direct. Microsoft has been doing this since before the Xbox, you know, when PC gaming was the only real, you know, sort of toe they had dipped into this market. So I'm still very positive on game streaming. We'll have to see if Nvidia can kind of shake up this market a bit more. I'd really like to see Sony get a bit more aggressive on how they position their offerings and their game catalog. Microsoft is the game is the outlet to beat. I can't even say, because it's like they're everything, like distribution, hardware, PC gaming, game streaming, and then owning a ton of the studios that are actually making the games. That is the most formidable piece of this competition. Excuse me. But I don't believe that that means Stadia is immediately dead. We just need to see if Google can pivot. That's really, again, I think it's fair to have some skepticism and some criticism, but it doesn't mean that I feel like this is immediately the death knell for Stadia. It maybe a smarter application of resources and the ability to kind of prime a certain type of consumer who's into Google services. If you can get Stadia up and running better on current gen Chromecasts, like, you've got a pretty good roadmap. You've got some good runway to get people using the service, but it definitely gives someone a little pause for concern if they're going to pull resources like game development. Dave Burns, Google needs to invest in their platform and risk 5 years of failing to actually innovate. Man, your words to Google's ears, man. It's critically frustrating when you see someone jump in and jump out of a market in a year, because there's no way you're going to win. I want to go to these offices and slap around a bunch of middle managers and say, like, what are you doing? you're just reinforcing why no one should ever get into game distribution, game development, or game streaming. You're proving to this community that you can't stick it out, so you should only go with the sort of current market leaders in these types of setups. And it's just so frustrating. It's so frustrating watching that cycle just continuously reinforce. ER1980, I am having plenty of fun playing Cyberpunk 2077 on Stadia on my Pixel 4 XL, Google Chromecast Ultra, and Chrome browser on my PC. And again, I think it's pretty funny that Cyberpunk seems to play best on Stadia. Just saying. TK Bay, the service is great and was a big push in playing Cyberpunk without issues at launch, so they will survive. They just need to pivot. I feel it's likely Stadia can weather this storm. I just, again, there's a reason why we don't have a ton of faith in Google. So, but we got to see. Again, it's a wait and see. And you sit out on the sidelines and you keep waiting to see if something's going to get better and you don't actually participate. It's tough. It's really hard. I mean, we want these things to be better, but they can't really get better unless more and more people are actually using them. So I don't know. We'll see. McCorkran 3. Oddly, Stadia works well on my Chromebook and phone, but it doesn't work as well on my Chromecast Ultra. I feel like game streaming is, I mean, not unique to Stadia. I think that's going to be an issue all around. All right, let's move through some quick political news. Since I've started this podcast, I've really tried to keep some high-profile tech political stories generally in our sights. If there's news about right to repair, if there's news about net neutrality, broadband distribution, moves at the FCC, one of the most critical stories that's kind of cropped up over the last couple of years is how tech platforms have utilized protections under the Communications Decency Act. And specifically, we've been looking a lot at Section 230 of the CDA. Trump wanted to abolish it. He actually tried to sign an executive order, which never would have passed any kind of constitutional or judicial muster. The examination immediately kind of laughed his executive order out of the room. But that's not to say that we need to examine the relationship that tech companies have, big data, with consumers and with politicians. And one of the ways to do that is going to be refining what takes place in Section 230. Section 230 is, to grossly oversimplify, is the protection that a platform like Facebook or YouTube or Google, they cannot be held directly responsible for the content that's published on their platform. And the reason why this is problematic is because a Facebook can operate like a publisher, and it can operate as an editorialist, and it can operate as all of these other different permutations of media. But they hide behind the protection that it's not on us what we publish, but we completely manipulate your feed to benefit us and our advertisers, but we're not really a publisher, but we totally control the publishing, but we don't, but we do. And it's this sort of double standard. And they've been able to operate with this kind of having it both ways protections. We need to be very careful with scalpel edits to how Section 230 works. It can fundamentally break how we interact with services online. If YouTube is to be held more directly culpable for the information that's put up on YouTube service directly from the government, not just from like copyright holders, that is a very sensitive issue. That is a very sensitive position to make adjustments to. We need grownups in there that are going to look at this stuff, but we need to be hypercritical about how this stuff goes down. So we've seen a transition of power. The Senate Democrats now have a tie-breaking vote with the Vice President, Kamala Harris, and we're starting to get the early word. We need to keep our eyes on these developments And this is where I'm going to ask, you know, especially for the Americans here in my stream, whether you're liberal or conservative, we need to be vocal. You know, any time that we might spend complaining about internet on the internet, we need to instead be writing our elected officials and voicing our concerns and voicing our support for the policies that we're examining. So Protocol has an early write-up on the Democrats' plan to limit Section 230. Three top Democrat. Oh, wait, who wrote this up? Emily Birnbaum and Izzy Lipowski at Protocol.com. Three top Democrat senators added to the stack of proposed Section 230 reforms Friday, introducing their own bill that creates narrow carve-outs for a range of online harms, dramatically limits the scope of behaviors that Section 230 covers, and takes aim at illicit activity that online platforms directly profit from. The so-called Safe Tech Act was introduced Friday by Senators Mark Warner, Mazzurano, and Amy Klobuchar. Under the bill, online platforms would not be able to claim Section 230 immunity for alleged violations of federal or state civil rights laws, antitrust laws, cyberstalking laws, human rights laws, or civil actions regarding a wrongful death. The law would strip companies of immunity for any speech they were paid to carry, such as ads or marketplace listings, and it would make clear that Section 230 does not shield companies from complying with court orders. This is a lot. So this is quite a bit. I would highly recommend giving this a read through. I feel there, again, whether this came from Democrats or Republicans, I feel there's a lot in this for us to be concerned about, and we want to dig into the particulars, not just the sort of cliff notes, you know, the article here posted. You can look up the Safe Tech Act and look through exactly what it is that our politicians are proposing. And from there, we need to have some grown-up debate on what we feel might go too far, what might not go far enough, and finding some happy medium where we actually do have a good regulatory policy over how these companies operate. Right now, we're using the Communications Decency Act, which was enacted in the 90s, to try and safeguard consumer interests against mega big data corporations. And I feel that's been insufficient. We need a stronger regulatory arm, and we need actual measures that prevent some of the consumer harms that befall misinformation campaigns, the abuse of consumer data, privacy issues. We need a lot of work. These are the first steps that we're going to need to take. Examining a 20-year-old law, or, you know, a section of a 20-year-old law, to start refining how we go about doing business online. Heike, another person who's been joining this conversation, mentioning Louis Rossman. So if you want kind of the counterpoint to my feeling on some of this stuff, where Louis Rossman and I agree on a huge Venn diagram overlap, I'm definitely more of a left-leaning individual, and I feel Rossman is probably a better example of a more libertarian style conversation. And reality is probably somewhere in between the two of us. And I very much value, and I very much respect, while I might disagree on some of the particulars, I've adored the type of visibility that Rossman brings to topics like right to repair. And that's where my left-leaning protection of small businesses and regulation over monster mega corporations totally lines up with his stance on a free and open market, allowing for more competition in a space like gadget repair, and trying to remove the largest tech companies from their positions of influence over our elected officials. We probably vote very different tickets on individual, like state issues and federal issues, but there we have a huge amount of agreement. And so really it would just be the particulars of how we would try and enact that kind of change in policy. So again, I think he is, if you're not subscribed, if you're not following his channel on YouTube, I love how cranky and ranty he gets. It's right in line with my style of commentary, even though we would disagree on a lot of the finer particulars.
we both agree that there are major problems with how this stuff is going down now. And yeah, Gary the Fireman, his snark level is right up there. And so, again, you want to join conversations on things like right to repair. Rossman, totally your dude. iFixit. If you're not following iFixit, you need to be following iFixit. But these are some of the other issues that are facing the technology landscape. When we say, oh, I don't want to talk politics, that means you're going to allow politicians to decide for you what can and can't be posted on the internet, what the rules are. If you don't contribute to that conversation, you have no business complaining when suddenly a YouTube starts shutting channels down, or when a Facebook has to get involved because of federal laws as to what communities can be populated on that service. So it's proper critical. I mean, you really need to be a part of the conversation. So this is one that we definitely need to keep our eyes on. As much as I want to side left-leaning, and I've supported Democrats in our last campaign, I'm still anxious about what they're going to come up with to protect the children whenever we need to clutch our pearls and be outraged about something. And JJ, this is a great point, but you know, we need to be able to have the conversation and not debate whether or not there's a problem. So JJ writes, but there are still concerns about regulation when it comes to online content. When does one's definition of misinformation infringe on a mainstream opinion not touted by coastal elites? Well, first of all, coastal populations typically aren't elite. Coastal populations just vastly outnumber rural populations. So already, rural populations are overrepresented in our government. If you want to look at the voting power of the House of Representatives and you want to look at the voting power of the Senate, these coastal elites, our votes don't count as much. So already, if this was really a concern that the more conservative-leaning areas of this country wanted to have, they should have had it while they had the bulk of the representation in our House, in our Senate, in our executive branch, and in our judicial branch. But they didn't really care about rural individuals and these kinds of issues when they had those levers of power. I feel like whenever we bring up this boogeyman of, but when will you infringe upon our rights? Often what you're saying is, I want to infringe on the rights of Google and Facebook, and I want to infringe on the rights of Amazon. Google and Facebook have no, they're private platforms, they're private institutions. And so they are not forced to publish anything they don't want to publish. Twitter has no legal liability, really, to publish something that they don't want to publish. So if you're really concerned about whether or not you can force Twitter to post misinformation and rancid conspiracy theories, then what you're saying is, I want to infringe on the rights of private corporations, private institutions, and private individuals. I want the government to be able to tell Twitter they have to publish what I want them to say. And I don't feel that's a very conservative stance. I feel conservatives should be even more outraged at compelled speech. I want the government to be able to force you to say something on a private platform. We can have every argument about whether or not Google is a private institution. They are. They're a private company. They're not a form of the government. If we want to enact some sort of public platform, you want to really get involved on something like C-SPAN or some sort of like PBS or some sort of taxpayer-funded branch where you can have more of an open communication that's free of those kinds of restrictions of a private platform, that's great. Unfortunately, conservatives also tend to vote against those types of publicly funded institutions. They tend to vote against things like turning the internet into more of a utility. We had that kind of regulation at the FCC under Democrats, and you know, we were going to classify the internet as a telecommunications platform, regulate it more like a utility, and then conservatives blew that up. So again, wherever we start hearing this dog whistle, I'm so concerned about trampling on other people's freedoms. Okay, but even just taking that argument at its face value, What do we do about conspiracy theories regarding disease, the spread, the pandemic, 5G, flat earthers, anti-vaxxers? No, I don't really feel like any private company has any, there's any obligation to protect that kind of speech. I'm not bothered by it. If that kind of stuff gets nuked, this is totally my personal opinion, and feel free to disagree with me. We've seen the worst ills of our society magnified by people gaming these social media platforms for their own self-interests, targeting the most vulnerable and undereducated of our communities, and convincing them to also act and vote against their own self-interests. So if you're worried about protecting that kind of speech, I can't really be bothered to join you. Outside of, I just don't think the government should prosecute for crazy, seditious conspiracy theories. You can go and say it, but no one has any obligation to publish it. And that's where your free speech protections stop. Your free speech protections stop at you trampling someone else's free speech. That's it. There's no obligation that someone needs to be forced to publish your speech. All right. We got a few more and we're going to get out of this here. sorry. I noticed there was like a whole conversation about like wings and I actually am kind of hungry. So, let me knock this out real quick. This is coming from BuzzFeed. Let me pull this up here. Written up by Ryan Mack and Rosie Gray, Parler wanted Donald Trump on its site. Trump's company wanted a stake. Now, before Trump was removed from most of social media, apparently Parler and the Trump Organization, and again, this is capitalized, the Trump Organization, were negotiating on the president having a stake in Parler. But it would have meant that he would have been an exclusive communicator on Parler. So this is coming by way of BuzzFeed, and I'm hoping that a little bit more information can be brought up on how this deal fell apart. Because, you know, however much you might feel about BuzzFeed, I'm not, you know, tremendously thrilled about citing them as a sort of news organization or news agency. But, you know, there are a couple other links in this. This is actually a really long write-up of what kind of information was passed back and forth between the Trump org and Parler. But Trump was apparently offered a 40% stake in Parler. And now it's just kind of interesting that since he's been removed from so many social media platforms and that deal fell apart, that he's not really had an opportunity to join any kind of public conversation outside of just being mentioned in other sort of conservative news broadcasts. So again, when we look at the sort of issues facing what might happen in regulations, what happens for, you know, platforms like Parler that can get removed because they have to be hosted on other private servers and private institutions, this is another kind of data point. I'm not sad about Parler, and I'm not sad about Trump getting deplatformed, but as a legal trend, we need to be very critical and very conscious of what goes down in regulating online speech. Again, your protections for free speech stop at the government telling you to shut up, and that's it. If we make everything a free market, private company solution, then those companies get to decide what gets published. And it has nothing to do with your First Amendment rights. It only has to do with some of the most aggressive aspects of a capitalist society. Again, where I feel like libertarians and hardcore leftists probably see eye to eye on a number of issues. Do we want Facebook determining what is safe speech? I do not. And McCorcoran, right. It's possible to agree with the platforming. I think you mean deplatforming Trump on a temporary basis while also being incredibly uncomfortable with the fact that Facebook and Twitter are making these decisions. I feel all of us should be able to agree on the notion that Facebook being the gatekeeper is bad for everyone. And from there, we can move on. All right. One last one. And again, in talking about using platforms and getting a message out there, this is where I need to poke fun at my side just a little bit. I was actually really happy to see how the Biden administration is bringing back news briefings that are more grown up and less explosive, and, you know, people just lying directly to reporters in the White House newsroom. Again, it's just a more straightforward, you know, like West Wing style kind of grown up conversation. I was also interested to hear that President Biden is going to be bringing back a weekly address. I'm not sure it should go down like this. So I can't really play the video. I mean, like, if I do in any of the audio, you know, my channel will get nuked for, you know, copyright takedowns and matched content ID. So all I'm going to do is just pull up like the video here. So this is a weekly conversation on the line with Michelle. So this is the official White House YouTube account. And the Biden administration is looking at bringing back weekly addresses in a more casual format where, and I really hope they refine this. I really hope they fix this. Michelle gets to have a short phone call with President Biden talking about some of her struggles recently. I think she's just recently lost her job and how the pandemic has affected her family. And it's, I don't know if it's scripted, but it's edited in a way where it feels kind of hokey and infomercially. You know, these are like very general and broad talking points that Democrats kind of nod along with. The production value is supposed to feel very casual, like, oh, we're just getting this little slice of life, just a little glimpse in on what these two folks are talking about. And just one of them happens to be the president of the United States sitting at his desk. I like what they're trying. I don't like how it's executed because it feels very emotionally manipulative. It takes real person concerns and kind of propagandizes them into a boiled down lowest common denominator, agree people should help people kind of way. And I miss, you know, again, presidential addresses and what used to, you know, be a radio address, simple, straightforward, direct to the press, talking about what the administration had been working on over a certain period of time and the progress being made. I'd kind of like just to get back to that. If you want to host that on something like YouTube, I don't feel you need the shtick of manipulating a conversation to appeal to someone in a reality show, a reality TV show kind of way. So again, the White House YouTube account now is just featuring videos from the Biden swearing in ceremony on. I want to see a few more of these weekly addresses just to see if they improve. I'm not feeling super positive on the format that they've got right now. So we'll see.
Just a quick interjection here, folks. I love highlighting good work and talented people, producers and writers who deserve more attention. So here's a quick word from someone making cool stuff on the internet, and I hope you check out what they have to offer.
Hey, it's Sam.
And this is Matt.
And we're Across the Podcast with Sam and Matt, the best podcast you never heard of. Tune in every Sunday at 3 p.m. Central Standard, 9 p.m. BST in the UK, for a lot of talk about tech and food and football. Not the right kind, the wrong kind.
Not hand egg.
Not hand egg.
Nope.
It's a good time. We talk to guests. Sometimes we just talk to each other, but just about whatever the hell comes on our show. You should come check it out. It's on Spotify, Apple Podcasts. What else? Twitch. It's on Twitch, right?
Pretty sure it's on Twitch, yeah.
Yeah, it's on Twitch. YouTube? It's on the YouTubes?
Yeah, it's on the YouTubes. Generally just everywhere.
Right. It's everywhere, and everyone should be listening. So if you haven't paid attention, you should pay attention. It's Matt. It's Sam. AcrossThePodcast.com. Go check it out. What else you got to do? I mean, it's Sunday. Not like you got family or nothing. All right.
Nope.
Be good. Enjoy your tech. Enjoy your year. Bye, everybody.
Stay safe.
Yeah, do that too. Wear a mask.
DTNL, POTUS be working a call center. Aditya is also saying POTUS needs to play Among Us. I'm cool with AOC running the Twitch game. Do it. Do it. I'm going to call BS if suddenly we see like Biden on Twitch, like, so kids, this is how I've been leveling up in control. Like, that's, no, no, I don't buy it. And Dave Burns, yeah, it is definitely better than what we had in the last presidential administration talking on Twitter. But he also says it's still gross and taking advantage of people. I see what they're going for. I don't think this is the way to execute that. Again, we should all be very concerned about how information gets out to people, how we propagandize, or how we sort of move the goalposts in a conversation for one side or the other. I don't think this is it. Again, liberals have been terrible at messaging. My entire political life, the left side of the equation has been absolutely miserable at generating the same kind of passion or involvement as conservative media. You know, every time we try and do something Fox News style, but with more integrity, it just falls apart. MSNBC does not represent me. Radio attempts like Air America were awful. I mean, like, I consider myself pretty far left, and I'd be listening to people ranting and raving and screaming their heads off, and like, this is not me. This doesn't apply. So we need to get savvier. Liberals need to get way better at getting messaging and commentary out there in a way that's more easily digestible by the very people we claim to be trying to support and protect. So, MSNBC is owned by Comcast. Not exactly a bunch of raging Marxists. Oh, and Dave Burns, my dad loves MSNBC. I wish he would turn it off. Yes. Get him to turn it off. It's so much better. It's so much better for your life. Again, so all of my family in the same thing. Like, the few family members I've convinced away from Fox News are all just happier and healthier than when they were, like, doom watching, you know, people scream about conspiracy theories and outright lying to their audience. How about we just move on? If you're looking for better sources of information, especially as it pertains to technology, I have a subreddit that you might be interested in. This is a community of people that are coming together to support content that they feel deserves more attention. I am, of course, referencing reddit.com/r/glowingrectangles. And I had the best week I've ever had on my own subreddit. It is not often that I not only win, but I outright dominate on my own subreddit. This is not a subreddit about me. This is not a subreddit about my podcast. This is genuinely a place to share content. And the mission is to share content you feel deserves more attention. As things get popular on the subreddit, hopefully they spread to other communities and get popularized and more easily featured in search. So, reddit.com/r/glowingrectangles. A number one, some gadget guy with a tech reviewers are scum video. Boom. Number two, best of our week, episode 8 with TK Bay. TK shares some amazing impressions on his S21 Ultra shenanigans. And we also had a lovely conversation about audio gear and replacing the missing headphone jacks from our phones. Number two, just awesome good times. And number three, Alt Dad Tech, who currently doesn't even show subscribers when you hover over his face. Number three video, can you trust some gadget guy? I never thought I would be the feature of someone's sort of video essay on the veracity or the trustability of a YouTube content creator. Like, Jason didn't even make one of these on me when he was doing his series of Can You Trust videos. So someone digging into my gadget review style, number three video on Glowing Rectangles. I got reviewed. Reviewing the reviewer. I really genuinely never felt like that would be something someone would take enough of an interest in my channel to do. An expose or video diary. I gotta say, it was a little uncomfortable watching someone talk about me. I wonder, you know, like whenever I bring up like a smartphone and I'm talking about like how the phone works, I wonder if the PR people are like, I wonder what he's gonna say. I wonder if it makes him uncomfortable, because being the subject of a video felt kind of weird. Definitely kind of weird. But yeah, my face, top three on my own subreddit. Boom, boom, boom. Rounding out the rest of the popular stories, we've got Adam Reviews Tech with 1,600 subscribers, kind of cautioning against buying a Galaxy S21 Plus. Also, he took the next spot with a review on the Xbox Series X and how he absolutely loves the console. Right after that, my interview with Marie, talking about the Pixel 4a 5G. What is that? Number six position. We've got Techspert. We've got Zach Talks Tech. Someone shared a link to XDA developers talking about unlocking the bootloaders on LGs, my Aftershocks, and then tech tablets rounding out the top 10. Galaxy S21 Ultra review. It's not a keeper. Overhyped cameras. And I'm not going to be digging specifically into tech tablets video here on the S21 Ultra, but there's a consistency in some of the commentary we've been seeing on the new phones coming out for 2021 that we are going to be talking about once we get through the rest of the gadget blog. So reddit.com/r/glowingrectangles. We were just talking about how platforms like Facebook and YouTube manipulate the content that you see in your subscription feed. Just because you follow, just because you subscribe, just because you smash bell icons, doesn't mean YouTube is going to serve you up that video content. YouTube has a vested interest in trying to keep you on the platform for as long as they can. So they're not going to follow your recommendations. They're going to try and serve you video content that will keep you watching and streaming videos. So it gets to be kind of a narrow niche focus for anyone who's watching content on YouTube. YouTube gets in the way between content creators and their audiences. So if you'd like to separate yourself from some of that, catch a broader tech conversation, reddit.com/r/glowingrectangles. Every week, I'm finding new content creators. I'm catching up with channels that I haven't seen on YouTube for a while. They're still making stuff, but I'm not getting notified. And it's just generally a broader and more inclusive conversation about consumer tech and audio tech and fun gadgets and gizmos. We always need as much participation and as much support as we can get. So getting in there, sharing content you feel deserves more attention. Don't be stingy with the upvotes. Get some stuff up there. Get it popular. It's going to spread to other communities. And then also, you know, sharing directly from the subreddit so that people can see that this is an engaged community, that we're actually trying to do this legit, grassroots. And we're not trying to game the system, but we are trying to benefit. So reddit.com/r/glowingrectangles. I love what this community has been posting, especially when I win my own subreddit. I'm super great. Do, do, do. McCorkran 3, I think you're talking about tech tablets. The poor guy has probably burned every bridge with every major smartphone manufacturer. Maybe not. I don't know. Again, with a channel his size, I wonder if Samsung's still like playing the numbers on like, he can be the outlier, but it'll still give us more potential exposure because he's got 300,000 subscribers. I don't know. That stuff gets weird. I know I'm definitely not big enough, or I'm definitely way too snarky for Samsung to ever reply to my emails ever again. All right, let's talk about some gadgets real quick. How are we feeling about how unfairly OnePlus phone cameras are often reviewed? I shot a lot. I still shoot quite a bit on my OnePlus 8 Pro. This has an incredible main camera sensor. It's still got one of the best ultra-wide camera sensors I've ever used. And it's got a sensor size that's rivaling. It's right behind you know, the 108 megapixel sensors that you'll find on significantly more expensive Galaxies. I've been pretty positive. I actually have enjoyed OnePlus HDR processing. It's contrastier. It's a little darker. I like what they do with shadow info better than what Samsung has been doing recently. So when this sort of leak broke, what was it, Dave 2D showed us a look. I'm pulling this up from the Engadget article written about it. This is written up by John Fingas. But Dave 2D obtained images of what looks to be a OnePlus 9 Pro. And on this Domino camera module, there's a label. And that label is a very interesting label if you're into photography, where the label says Hasselblad. And Hasselblad is a very well-respected camera manufacturer, makes medium format camera backs, camera bodies. There's the camera that astronauts took to the moon. So long as you actually understand reality and you know that astronauts landed on the moon and you don't think that that was some wacko conspiracy theory propagated by Stanley Kubrick. Hasselblad. We dig on Hasselblad camera tech. I'm not sure how I feel about a Hasselblad label on a phone. Do we think that this is going to change significantly? There are two factors here. If Hasselblad is putting this label on a OnePlus 9, does that mean that they have any influence over the camera hardware? Or is it more the camera processing, the photo processing, the video processing in software? Those types of relationships are always a little bit fluid, where you'll see Leica branding, Zeiss branding on different cameras and on different products. And it doesn't necessarily always mean what you think it means. Like, you see Leica on a phone. Did they make the lenses for those cameras? Did they just certify that the lenses were good? Did they focus on the post-processing to make a Leica feel out of the JPEGs for the camera? That's what I'm kind of interested in. I mean, there are definitely some sticky spots on a OnePlus camera app. But I feel like OnePlus cameras have kind of been unfairly targeted in smartphone reviews. In much the same way that I complain about Apple. If you shoot predominantly on Apple, then everything else starts to feel wrong because you're familiar with how an iPhone takes photos. If you shoot predominantly on a Samsung and then you pick up a OnePlus, oh, well, this isn't as good. It's different than how my Samsung operates. I see a lot of that kind of commentary where you've already kind of picked your winner based on what you're most familiar with. So while I still feel like there's definitely some room for improvement on how the OnePlus camera app works, it is phenomenally better than where we were in like the OnePlus 5 days. Again, every year I kind of feel like OnePlus deserves the most improved award. And this last gen, if you slept on the OnePlus 8 Pro, you slept on a pretty terrific all-rounder consumer camera experience. Not great for pros. Especially if you care about locking in your video settings, that goes to Sony. But tremendously good, phenomenally good for exactly the kind of experience that reviewers say consumers want. So I'm kind of anxious. I mean, a Hasselblad label probably didn't come cheap. I love that the OnePlus 9 Pro is still going to demonstrate a pro, not pro as in professional, but a premium experience. I want OnePlus to keep making the premium phones while they're also kind of blowing up expectations with the Nords and their sort of mid-range offerings there, especially with 5G devices coming in cheaper. It makes me anxious because it sets up very unrealistic expectations. And I kind of already have a feeling that tech reviewers are going to pick this up. They're going to shoot 3 or 4 photos in full auto HDR. And now let me show you why the photos that I shot on my Galaxy are better. And, you know, this is just fake branding. It's just a label. It's just a way for Hasselblad to spend money or make money on this. It's a total just branding exercise. And they're not really going to test harder than that. And the thing that also makes me a little anxious is the last time we saw Hasselblad in the mobile space was on a Motorola Moto mod. So that was garbage. That Moto mod was awful. Anyone who couldn't call out that that Moto mod was not good is bad at photography. So, you know, when I see things like this right here. Sorry, I got to call out John Fingas. Whether or not a Hasselblad partnership would help isn't certain. Motorola's Hasselblad branded phone mod offered a meaningful improvement to still shots, but you weren't about to mistake it for a studio quality camera. The only meaningful improvement was having a longer zoom range in the absolute best possible light. And even then, those photos were garbage. So you had more reach. Just you would never want to look at those photos ever again because they were awful. And the camera itself, the camera on the Z Force was so much better than the sort of normal range of shots from that Moto mod. I mean, like, it wasn't even close. So, yeah, very anxious, very, very curious to see what this partnership might actually mean. The main point is it could be kind of cool. Like, if Hasselblad is actually developing stuff with OnePlus, that could be fun. If we got something on a OnePlus that resembled sort of the bleeding edge that we saw from Huawei and Leica, where Leica really wasn't responsible for the lenses in a direct way, but they did really influence Huawei camera app design and software processing. That could be good. I could be down for that. Al Spockley, it's how you build the hype train. Hype train. Oh, some people saying it would be nice if we had a few more LG leaks or some LG rumors. I don't know, man. The LG commentary is definitely making me also a bit anxious. You know, again, I said this on Rolando's podcast. I think I said it on Rolando's podcast. That at least if LG, I don't believe they will. I believe we'll get LGs out this year. I just think it's the normal LG sort of marketing vacuum that happens where they're just not putting a lot of effort behind their conversation. But I'm still fairly positive we'll see a V70. But if something crazy happens and we don't, that at least I'll still have Sony. Like, I'll be down to one player in the market, but at least I'll be able to point to a Sony and say, like, oh, I still have a phone that's made for me. All right, let's knock out something else. And then I want to get to the sort of core conversation here. We were just talking about Hasselblad. Wired has a great write-up on something that could be really cool. Again, I'm going to have this linked in the show notes. A new lens technology is primed to jumpstart phone cameras. And I just want to scroll down to this image right here. What this company is doing is building these crazy nanoparticle light tubes to help correct for the distortion that comes from a smartphone camera lens. So you notice, like, when we start talking about these larger camera sensors, we've been seeing these camera modules get chunkier and deeper and chunkier and bigger, sticking out like these domino warts on the backs of our phones. And the reason why is when we go to a larger image sensor, we need more lens and lens elements to correct for how light is supposed to hit that camera sensor and resolve the image. More lens elements can also degrade, you know, the quantity of light that's hitting that sensor. There are more opportunities to create aberrations or fringing. We definitely see, you know, on these this sort of current generation of larger sensors, this is new tech. And we're seeing a lot of issues with lens flaring and smearing and ghosting, depth of field not being quite as sharp, focusing performance. All of these things compound. So this company says that they've found a fix where it looks like this, like, rainbow test pattern. But what's happening is in one flatter plane, the light is warped and corrected so that it hits the sensor in the same way that multiple lens elements work currently on our phones. Our phones need to have different shapes of lenses so that as light hits from one angle, it's actually directed and focused onto the sensor in a way that makes the image look correct. Our smartphone camera sensors are actually ridiculously wide focal lengths. Like a smartphone camera sensor might have like a 4mm lens. That would look hilariously fisheyed if it were on a traditional larger sensored camera, standalone camera. It would almost look like it's kind of a spherical shape. We've got to do a lot of image manipulation to kind of pull that data to the sensor appropriately. So if this company has the magic bullet, that means our camera modules would get way shallower, or we would be able to use kind of the same depth of camera sensor, I mean, the same depth of camera module, but put in a significantly larger sensor. So if we want to get to like a 1-inch shooter, if this lens tech can scale, if we can build and we can improve on this, the, you know, like a domino shape on the back of our phone could be mostly sensor. And that would be insane. You really want to take a step up on smartphone photography. If we could go to 1-inch or APS-C or micro four thirds, like my camera here, if we could build a lens that could fit into the back of a phone like that, we would radically improve smartphone photography. So I am anxiously going to be following this company. MetaLens is the name of the company, M-E-T-A-L-E-N-Z. I would say keep your eyes on this company, see if they get bought out. Let's see if they get optioned by Samsung or by Apple. If we hear of an acquisition from a major smartphone manufacturer and the company that's being acquired is Meta Lens, then I think we'll see that there is some something interesting happening. Cough, cough, Lumia phones, cough, cough. JJ, I thought lens flares were a good thing. JJ Abrams, cough, 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 cough. That's hilarious. Google buys it and kills them. Gary, oh, that was dirty. Okay, so if Gary, what Gary just said, this is exactly how that would go down. I'm so disappointed that the Pixels are using a smaller camera sensor because I'm the Verge and I don't know how to shoot photography. Google just bought out this new company that's going to make lenses way better. And then, Google killed it so they could keep the same old camera sensor in the next gen Pixel. I gotta feel like I could see that series of headlines coming out. Who here would buy Apple VR? Is anyone interested in an Apple headset, mixed reality? one of the main outlets that covered this first, I caught it first on The Verge. Apple's rumored VR headset could cost $3,000, feature 8K displays and over a dozen cameras. So the article goes on to kind of talk about what some of the designs have looked like. We're technically calling this more of a mixed reality headset where the cameras could probably better interact with your environment, maybe give you a video feed and overlay stuff in an AR kind of way. But this is a very different, if Apple's going to do it, we know that they're going to do something very different than what Facebook is doing with the Quest 2. Where you pay $299 to have a Facebook camera and microphone system scan your home and invade your privacy. So that $299 is a steal to have a Facebook product invade every waking aspect of your daily life. I'm totally being cheeky there. So one of the things I'm actually kind of positive on, if any company can make a public consumer play for virtual reality, I'm actually really positive on Apple. I feel like if Apple puts their muscle behind a project, we were just joking about Google, right? Google buying up a lens company and then killing them. Google killing their in-house game development for Stadia. Google bought out my precious Focals, the company North. And I was so upset that Google bought them out because it pretty much guaranteed I would never get Focals 2. Like I loved the heads up display on Focals 1. If Apple is getting to a point where they might be consumer facing, we'll see advertising, we'll see marketing, we'll see high profile displays in public areas where people can look at this stuff. It sucks because there really isn't the same kind of VR opportunity for any other player. HTC didn't set up mall kiosks where you're walking through a mall and you can check out an HTC Vive, and wow, wouldn't that be cool? No other company is going to put boots on the ground, money into advertising, and enough incentives to bribe developers to actually take the platform seriously. So VR has actually been in this beautiful space of improving content, coming up with, you know, engaging new experiences. And we've seen developers support some of their older titles. Like, it is still fun to fire up Beat Saber. Like, that's a game I regularly keep revisiting. And it's one of Marie's all-time favorite gaming experiences. She flippin' loves slashing at blocks with lightsabers. Like, it's just so primal. If Apple were to do this, it would bring the most visibility to this consumer segment and could kick off a renewed interest in where we are now at VR. I feel a lot of people, I feel like I was wrong. When we were doing the Board at Work podcast, I was very positive on things like Cardboard, where you'd slot your phone into a makeshift cardboard headset, you know, so that you could kind of get a sample of what VR could be like. I really felt that that was going to be a good gateway drug so that people would maybe be interested in nicer experiences. I was wrong. I kind of feel like the early iterations of developer units, the first generation of the Oculus, Cardboard and Daydream only served to kind of quell consumer interest. It's too rough around the edges. It's not really ready yet. I tried it that one time, that VR thing, and it wasn't very good. So I never went back. I kind of feel like that's where VR got stuck. And too many people, I feel like, kind of stopped at maybe a PlayStation VR. Not bad, not a bad experience, but not great, kind of cumbersome, a lot of setup, additional costs, probably not worth it for the handful of games that they might enjoy playing. It sits in a corner or on a shelf and gathers dust. I mean, literally my Daydream is over on the bookshelf gathering dust. If anyone's going to rekindle, is going to kickstart, reignite some consumer interest, unfortunately, I think Apple might be one of the only players that consumers will trust to drive this kind of product experience. They did it with smartwatches. They did it with earbuds. Whether or not we really like those products or like what they represent, consumers got interested. So when I see Apple now more seriously making moves in this space and the rumor mill kind of lighting up a bit more, that by next year we'll maybe see one of these headsets in stores, that makes me a bit more interested. And also, I kind of feel it's important to point out, I want premium tier hardware. VR kind of depends on a nicer experience to really light up the interest in this product segment. And if we're talking, you know, like Apple custom silicon, completely contained and enclosed in this experience, kind of like Oculus, the Quest. It's, you're not tethered to a bunch of cables. It's not cumbersome. You just take a headset, you put it on your face, and you're off and running. Then I think consumers are going to gravitate to that. I'm going to get real pissed, though, if people start acting like a $3,000 Apple headset is some sort of de facto mainstream option, while tech reviewers have been savaging the more expensive headsets that often cost less than $1,000. Oh, I mean, it wasn't worth it enough on a Vive because you had to have a PC, and we're talking hundreds of dollars to get that Vive headset. But this $3,000 Apple is just normal. Again, kind of like the conversation we had around AirPods Max. You've got $280 worth of headphone in a $550 Apple shell. But we're now going to try and normalize AirPods Max as some kind of de facto iPhone standard. And that's not it. No, Google buys Apple, then kills it. Oh man, that's hilarious. Apple tax. But again, Apple can keep their profit margins pretty healthy that way. This was also shared on the Discord. We talked about this a couple of weeks back, just kind of highlighting it as a news article. But now there's actually been a little bit more study into this phenomenon. I'm not going to go too much into this. Henry Ford cardiologists find iPhone 12 magnet deactivates implantable cardiac devices. So this has been just a little bit more medical data, a little bit more study. This is from February 4th. They held a media briefing talking about defibrillators and the iPhone 12, and that this is a little bit different than what Apple was trying to claim. Apple's claim is, we've always said that, you know, the electrical and magnetic interference from pocket computers is a concern for people who have pacemakers or other durable medical equipment. And so they don't feel that there's any additional, I'm totally paraphrasing Apple PR here, and please don't take this as like, this is a direct quote from Apple and they said, whatever. So from what I read on Apple PR and Apple forums is, Apple doesn't feel like they need to make any additional disclosure to the safety of their products. Cardiologists are pointing to a slightly different relationship because the iPhone 12 magnets for their wireless charging system are more powerful, that this is a slightly different situation than previous generations of iPhone. We mentioned it. We had a very similar conversation when this first was brought up, that this could be an issue. My dad doesn't have a pacemaker, but is absolutely that person who would take a smaller phone and put it in a shirt or jacket pocket. So I feel this is just another piece of evidence. A proper group of cardiologists held a medical briefing that you can share with your family and friends just to point to, hey, grandpa, you have a pacemaker. If you buy the iPhone 12, keep it in your butt pocket and then we're good. But I do feel like just a little additional disclosure, a little additional conversation seems to be warranted, as the design of the iPhone 12 is different than the magnetic design of the iPhone 11. I think that's fair. It's not a don't buy, oh my gosh, so scary, it's going to kill your grandparents. That's not it. But I feel like, yeah, it's fair to have that conversation with your family and friends. All right, we're getting into like kind of the last 15 minutes here, and I did want to have sort of a more open conversation and focus in a little bit more on the comments coming here. As the title of this podcast was a little clickbaity, are new phones worth it? We're going to get to the bottom. Here's the truth. Bullet point number 3 is going to blow your mind. Top 10 shocked face thumbnail. Whoa, blow my mind. Is it worth it? So here's the deal. And please, as I start kind of breaking some of this stuff down, I'd love to. Simon says Hypno. Heartbeats by Apple. How much you want to bet that they come up with like a MagSafe interactive pacemaker? Do you feel like you just need to shut your heart down? There you go. MagSafe by Apple. sorry, I couldn't help that. New phones are coming out. Old phones are now apparently garbage. I went through that Reddit thread for the starter pack, the YouTube reviewer starter pack, and I had an hour-long conversation with my wife over a delicious bourbon, and some things got to change. Our community, techies, tech fans, people who really do genuinely enjoy the technology aspect of this consumer electronics conversation. A little self-awareness, a little sort of self-reflection, just some outside conversation from people who aren't as heavily invested in our tight-knit little community, and realizing that we're a very small component of the overall consumer landscape. There are no numbers that I can crunch to see if we really do have any kind of broader consumer impact. You know, when a big YouTube tech channel is pulling like 2 to 6 million views per video, I mean, assuming each one of those were a new viewer and they had no overlap with any other content creators, that channel would represent like a 0.3% impact on global sales. Like, I did the math on something else and I just don't have the notes here, so I don't care to go through all of it again, but it's less than 1%. That channel would be reaching less than 1% of potential smartphone consumers out there. And for 1 year, again, we're talking in 1 year, we can see as many as 1.5 billion phones sold. So how many people in this chat room, and if you're coming to this podcast after the fact, you know, drop me some comments on Some Gadget Guy, hit me up on Twitter. You know, there will be a video version of this that goes to YouTube. How many of you have sort of grokked or have sort of felt that when it's time for a family member to upgrade a device, they're not excited? They're not happy. They're frustrated. They're exhausted. They're confused. This is expensive. It's difficult to transfer info to a new device. They want to get a good deal, so maybe they try a trade-in, and then that can take 6 weeks to properly pay out, even though it seems like it's going to be an immediate one-to-one exchange. Or maybe they get tied into a carrier, and now they're on a leasing plan, and their smartphone bill just went up $40 or $50 a month. We are contributing to a conversation from trillion-dollar corporations that are all hype. We watch as every single new device comes out, and the marketing would make it seem that this is a revolutionary improvement over its predecessor. Now, those of us in this chat, in this live stream right now, And I'm especially pointing to you, we've gotten over that hype cycle. We kind of understand like, oh, there are going to be some improvements. There might also be some compromises, but you know, like generally it's going to be a better device than the generation that came before it. But we're probably not leaning into the unlabeled performance bar graphs from Apple, right? You know, in no specified way, this new product is 11 times better than this old product. We know that that's fake, right? We know that that's not real, or at least not in any kind of tangible or replicatable kind of way. So I've been bringing this up a lot in my videos and how disheartening it is to see some of these like studies and articles, like 9 out of 10 people see no benefit in upgrading their phone. And at the same time, we know that a lot of the people jumping on in the FOMO, and like they don't want to be left behind. They don't want to miss out. They want to get excited about a new purchase, or they're just in a position where they absolutely need to trade in an older phone. It's just not working for them anymore. And then they get it, and it's like, this is the same thing that I've always been doing before. My wife went from a Snapdragon 845 to a Snapdragon 765, and she is perfectly happy. Not only perfectly happy, it's just she has a newer phone and it's working better than her old phone. There is nothing she can point to in her daily use that would indicate she's missing out by not having a more powerful CPU-GPU combo. And in fact, even some things got better, like, you know, the camera works a little bit sleeker, it's a little bit smoother, and photos come out a little more vibrant. You know, like, what was the compromise? What was better? What would she have gotten if we had decided to push her to a V60 or a Galaxy Ultra of some form? I don't know that we can point to anything. So this article came out, and I want to credit Gary Explains first for showing just some back and forth performance comparisons between Samsung phones internationally, which use a Samsung processor, the Exynos, and Samsung phones in the United States, which use a Qualcomm processor, the Snapdragon 888. And so I'm going to screen share into here while we talk about some of this. But, you know, Anantech, I don't actually know where the syllabic emphasis should be. I've always said Anantech, but I've been told that that's incorrect. So looking at two phones from the same, or the same phone from a manufacturer, but with different core chipsets, the Exynos versus the Snapdragon, they do their normal run of benchmarking and performance testing. And again, we come to the conclusion that the Exynos version is slightly outperformed, but where we're really concerned is consistent performance. So when these phones really start cranking up, can they consistently perform as they run a little bit hotter, or as you know, the battery starts to run? And hold on, I want to get to this battery life, some of these battery life charts. So I'm looking through, you know, they're looking at PC Mark, and this is all synthetic benchmarking. So I want to highlight synthetic benchmarking isn't real life, but I want you to look at the top of their test here for PC Mark. Using your phone as some kind of work platform, an Asus ROG takes the top spot for battery life. The V60 is a close second. And then we start climbing down through OnePlus 8s, the Galaxy S20 Ultra, Huawei Mate 30s, Oppo Reno, Note 20 Ultra, OnePlus 7 Pro. And we're climbing down like substantially to get to the Galaxy S21 Ultra with the Snapdragon 888 at 120 hertz with 2/3 the battery life performance in this benchmark as compared to the LG V60 from last year.
Hey, podcast listeners. I work really hard to find mutually beneficial ways to support production on my various distribution platforms. Instead of just running ads on this podcast and hoping they don't annoy you, I want to find products or services that you really will get something out of and that can help fund my production. While I do talk about some of those items in ads throughout this podcast, I've never created one easy-to-view master list of my current partnerships until now. Sorry, I couldn't help myself. If you'd like to help contribute, support production of this podcast and my various videos and reviews, head on over to somegadgetguy.com. At the top, there's going to be a link for Support Some Gadget Guy, and you can see what my current partnerships are. At the time this podcast was recorded, in addition to my Patreon, we can hook you up with a $10 voucher for shopping a new OnePlus, save 20% on some One More headphones, sign you up for Google Fi service, Amazon affiliate links, Audible, or you can grab a Mega Pickle coffee mug of your very own. Savory, delicious Mega Pickles. Head on over to somegadgetguy.com, support banner on the top right-hand side of my website, and hopefully you find something cool, something you like, while also kicking me a little extra scratch.
When we look at the manufacturer's claims, Samsung and Qualcomm, huge numbers. And we talked about this before on the podcast. I want to say it was a little bit more than a month back. You know, like, man, Snapdragon 888, we could see as high as a 30% improvement in CPU performance, up to a 40% improvement in GPU performance. That could be insane. So theoretically, that is true. And Anantech, went through and did a whole bunch of tests. But the real sustained performance, as these phones get hotter for having more powerful internals, we're kind of looking at the same iterative improvements that we've always seen. Probably about a 10 to 15% improvement in practical application and sustained workload year over year. So I really want to highlight this because, you know, a 10 to 15% bump, that ain't nothing to sneeze at. Improvements should always be appreciated. But to get that, 10 to 15% sustained improvement, it kind of looks like it's a hit to the battery life. So I really want to ask, look at your circles of family and friends. How many of them are going to care about getting a 4 frame per second boost in a video game, but shaving 15 to 20% off of their battery life from a competing product that they could buy a lot cheaper from 2020? And I think that's actually a harder sell. I think if we were to go to a number of our family and friends and say, like, do you want 4 to 6 more frames per second in this one game that a bunch of tech nerds like to play? Or would you like your battery to last 3 additional hours out in the field? What do we think they would say? I think in my circle of family and friends, the battery would probably be more critical. I want to see if I can get, they had some benchmarks on like iPhone performance versus Android performance. I'm trying to see if I can pull this up. So let me just go back to the Annen Tech charts here. Looking at, again, this is benchmarking. This isn't like an actual game. It's not real world performance. It's synthetic performance. But again, even iPhones are falling prey to this same issue where peak performance has improved tremendously. Like, that's a 25% jump to the peak performance of the iPhone 12 over the iPhone 11, but the sustained performance is lower on the iPhone 12. So if you only use your phone in a very short, rapid burst of GPU performance, it's going to look awesome. If you try to drive that experience for any length of time, you're better off with an iPhone 11 Pro. It's going to perform better over time than the iPhone 12 Pro. And I don't feel this is getting through when we're talking about this as techies. So when we look at the sustained real-world performance, or I shouldn't say real-world, when we look at the sustained synthetic performance, Snapdragon 865s are currently able to hang or outperform the Snapdragon 888. So, I mean, if you're watching this, you can see the bar graph. If you're listening to this, OnePlus 8 is one of the top performers. Now, that totally vibes with the performance testing that I do, where I'm rendering videos and batch editing raw files from a Sony camera and doing RAR compression tests. The OnePlus 8 was one of the top tier performance phones of the last generation. The OnePlus 8 looks like it's able to significantly outpace the Snapdragon 888 in the Galaxy S21 Ultra under a sustained synthetic benchmark. Like, that difference is more than 10%. Now, the burst, the peak output of the S21 Ultra is higher, like quite a bit higher. But that's not what we care about. We don't care about having 30 seconds of gameplay at 70 frames per second. We want all the gameplay to be more consistently fluid. And the OnePlus 8 and the LG V60. Also, if we're comparing the V60 against the S21 Ultra, better sustained performance scores, less heat, less battery drain, better performance. Last year's phones seem to offer better sustained performance. And this isn't an Apple versus Android thing. On the iPhones, last year's iPhone seems to deliver better sustained performance, or I should say, the iPhone 11 Pro, the 2019 iPhone, seems to deliver better sustained performance than the iPhone 12 Pro. So we're getting real hyped up about power. Every year, we're going to sell you a new phone that performs so much better than the phone that came before it. But I still got to ask. Talk to your family and friends. I had a lovely conversation with my wife. We don't often talk tech. you know, we have to work on Lex's school and her work at home and what's going on in the video game industry and what's going on in my tech industry and contracts and negotiations. We don't just, you know, like pick up a phone and talk about the phone. So this was actually kind of rare for us, for her to pick up a Pixel 4a and talk about the Pixel 4a. What is it that we're doing on these devices that this power would benefit us? Because I'm tired of pointing to a Geekbench bar graph or a synthetic benchmark in a keynote and using that as some kind of evidence that, like, this experience has been improved because of this one specious performance test. And that's why you should flip your phone. And that's why this iPhone costs $1,200. And this is why a Galaxy is so much more expensive. So when I point to things, like when I say, like, hey, I don't think the Galaxy S21 is a very good buy. I think a lot of consumers would be better off buying a Galaxy S20 or a Galaxy S20 Plus, maybe a Galaxy S20 FE. You know, I think you get more phone. It's a little older, so you're not going to have as many software updates, but you'll get more phone stuff, higher resolution screen, MagStripe payments, micro SD card support. And apparently, it's also going to be a better performing device. Like, the sustained performance, as we look at the Exynos version of the S21 Ultra, is falling behind the iPhone SE, the Mate 40 Pro, all of, like, the 865 phones, like the Xperia 1 Mark II. And it's really close to Snapdragon 855 performance. So especially if you're an international consumer, as we're looking at synthetic benchmarks, grain of salt, huge rock of salt, definitely don't take all of this just as on its face value. But when we look at a GPU score like this, you could own a Galaxy S21 Ultra or lose out on 3 frames per second and pick up a Galaxy S10 Plus and be really close. I mean, like, that's rough. So then you pick up like a Pixel 4 XL and like, oh man, Snapdragon 855. Yeah, actually, the 855 and the neural core in the Pixel 4 probably still able to outperform what Qualcomm's newest, latest, and greatest, and especially in Exynos, especially Samsung's. It's just nuts. DTNL S10E FTW. Simon says, Hypno, I loved the V60. Battery life was a huge reason for that adoration. Oh, and Zelk Knight. Yep, Pixel 4 XL was my favorite phone, but the glass back came off, so I switched to the 5, infinitely better battery life. And again, if you weren't using the custom neural core co-processor in that Pixel 4, the Pixel 5 is a monster little communicator phone for that battery life. So I'm really torn. Because myself, personally, I want ever-increasing power capability. I get real cranky when I can't do something on my phone and I need to break out a laptop to get something done. Anything I can do to replace having to sit and focus in front of a monitor when I could be doing something more on the go. I'm wanting my phone to tackle more and more. But increasingly, for what I see consumer actual compute power needs, I've still not seen any good evidence to suggest that outside of 4K video rendering and the most graphics demanding gaming, that consumers need any more processing power than a Snapdragon 845. So not last year's chipset from 2020, not the year before from 2019. The processing power we've been working since 2018 seems more than sufficient. It's still probably a little overkill for a lot of the consumer applications that folks might need you know, folks might need to accomplish. So are new phones worth it? I mean, again, getting out of just the synthetic benchmarks, you know, Samsung has been removing features over the last 2 years of their phones. They've been selling you more power, but I don't see where we've had as many opportunities to really lay that power down. They won't give us the hardware for DeX to make DeX into a proper laptop replacement. Their chipsets are running really hot now, so we don't have very good sustained performance. What are we doing? I got to scroll up because there were a lot of comments here. Gary the Fireman, I want battery life. Dave Burns, Moore's Law sure is fun. ER1980, battery life, but most importantly, battery degradation is a problem for heavy users. Again, if you're sleeping on Sony, you're missing the coolest battery tech that I've seen on any phones. Al Spockley, the V60 is awesome for gaming. I can game for an hour with barely any heat felt on the back, even stuff like Genshin Impact. And I've gotten into the bad habit of my battery, my screen on time stats have been dropping because like I'll run a game and stream a movie and then use like, you know, really nice headphones. So I'm really working the quad DAC, all V60. It's bad. Don't get into that habit of multitasking with your media like that, because you kind of can't ever go back. And again, I love phones like the Duo, but I can nuke the Duo's battery if I really run it hard. The V60 just like keeps coming back for more. It's insane. Gabaletta, again, it looks like the 5-nanometer chips from Sammy are not as efficient as the previous 7-nanometer chips, which is why I'm not surprised that MediaTek went with a 6-nanometer. The processing and the fabrication, and I get what they're doing, but you know, the common knowledge is Android phones need a processor that can really compete with the Apple A series. Do they? I mean, especially if we look at an iPhone, what are folks doing on iPhones that processing power is needed? Again, I feel like most Apple consumers are probably floating somewhere around A10. Like that would be a perfect, like I can still pull out my OG 16 gigabyte original iPhone SE. And as a communicator, that thing is still snappy quick. I did get the battery replaced, so there has been some work done on that iPhone SE. And that's plenty for phone. I want to text, I want to tweet, I want to keep up with my email. It's this beautiful little pocket smartwatch of a phone. Quick bursts of activity, put it right back in my pocket. Geniusly one thumb. And if I have it paired with my Apple Watch, I like that so much better as an overall experience than even the newer iPhone SE, which is so much more powerful. No. With a new battery, my original iPhone SE hangs with and probably bests my new iPhone SE for battery life because it's not cooking the phone with a top tier premium chipset. So I want to be more excited. I'm a little anxious that this generation, the TikTok, we're not really going to get better performers, but I'm hoping we'll get better radios. But that's not consumer exciting. That's not very sexy. And I don't believe techies care about radios because they keep saying iPhones are great when they've had miserable modems and terrible radios for generations of phones. Now, suddenly, iPhones, yeah, because they've got that Qualcomm modem. Now we care about radio connectivity. BS. You did not care when you sold people iPhone 10s. So, the rest of the phone needs to be considered. I want to see, you know, not just a good screen, but like good quality, you know, consistency, where Samsung and Apple have had the same issues as every other manufacturer. Oh no, my OnePlus has green tint. So do iPhones. So do Galaxies. I really want to see those considerations for speaker and audio technologies, for haptic feedback, really getting those clean, sharp, delineating responses for when I'm using a gadget. I mean, that kind of stuff still matters and it still contributes to the cost of a device. but I'm real anxious. I don't see from the early days of this Galaxy S21 era that phones in 2021 are really going to represent improvements over 2020, and in many ways are going to be compromises over the phones that we had in 2020. When you see like performance stats and battery life stats on a V60 beating out an S21 Ultra, and you can pick up a V60 for cheap these days. Like, what are we doing? What is it that we're trying to hype up? What is it that we're trying to sell to other consumers? Sorry, I'm super way behind. From McCorcoran, in fact, if you're willing to live with an 855 and 4G, you can get 2019 flagships for $200, $300. I mean, just imagine the pricing on like an LG G8. You know, say again, do you care about better face scanning and having a fingerprint sensor? Because I gotta say, I took the G8 out just for a spin, kind of around the block. I ended up at a grocery store, had my mask on, couldn't do the face scanning, tapped the back fingerprint sensor. It was really nice. Having a smaller phone, great cameras, amazing audio, and the choice of face scanning or fingerprint sensor. G8, beautiful, beautiful real world experience. Software's still a little tweaky, but I put Nova Launcher on it. And again, according to these like performance stats, like my G8 is still perfectly competitive with the Exynos version of the S21. For Matt Tyler, my ROG phones have and are still are the kings of battery. The Pixels and Sony Xperias this year with better battery, those will be the best choices outside of a Xiaomi. I'd agree with that. Again, if LG, man, if people slept on the V60, they slept on a battery champ. From JJ, I would say software and security update length is worth it. You would. No, I mean, I think that's fair. A techie who is concerned about updates, absolutely. Consumers don't trust them. Too many times they've updated their phone and the phone has performed worse. From iPhones to Galaxies. My wife, we tried booting up after the podcast was done, we tried booting up her Galaxy S7 and it's unusable. Newest updates, whatever security patch it ended up on, it is non-functional. Technically, everything is still working, but that phone is garbage. So consumers don't have the same kind of knee-jerk reaction to long-term software support. And as long as the device is somewhat polished after its initial launch, that's all consumers really seem to care about. And then at some point, we got to say, like, we need a better system for security patches. Whether or not you get the latest and greatest operating system, more that seems to turn off as many consumers as it attracts. Because what if it changes a setting? What if it changes my UI? What if it puts apps into folders? You know, even some of my family and friends on iPhones have not liked turning on app drawers. Excuse me, the app library on their iPhones. That's not been what they're about. So again, this software conversation is a little bit more nuanced than just, oh, it needs 3 years of updates, or I got 5 years of updates on my iPhone. That's not always the hook. So if Google can really pull more of the security patching into Google Play system updates, which I've been getting a grip of, hey, we just updated Play services, reboot your phone. I feel like that's going to be perfectly adequate for the security concerns for most of the consumers buying these products. And after that, like, I just don't think folks really care about the operating system side. Like, if they're getting all of these great new features, if it changes too much of their device, it just seems to stress them out. So Gary the Fireman, okay, kind of to this point, other than battery life, guaranteed updates and timely security patches are my two biggest issues. OnePlus dropping the ball on updates will keep me in a Pixel of some type. So again, monthly, I totally get it. I'm actually not too bothered by patches every other month. like the security exploits that hit our phones, unless something disastrous comes around and we need to see some more aggressive action than like a bi-monthly. Is that how you would say that? Bi-monthly? Does that mean two updates a month, or does that mean an update every 2 months? I don't know. But like the security patches on the OnePluses have been fine. They haven't been as aggressive as the Pixel, but my last Pixel patch was a 4 megabyte update. Okay. I mean, that's good. I'm sure something got plugged that was a potential security threat in that security patch. I just don't know that the time it took to download and go through that process of the phone running the update in the background and then rebooting the phone. And then after that, I did get another Play Services update, which I also got on my OnePlus. Was that, how much more protected am I really? How much more of a consumer benefit is that really? And I just don't see it. I just don't see where that was such a critical factor that I can't recommend a OnePlus to someone who still might be security concerned. I feel like, no, the OnePlus updates every other month. You'll get like kind of an update package and they'll have some bug fixes in there. The camera generally improves throughout the life of the phone because it's a OnePlus. They always do that. Like, I feel like that's fine. I don't feel like that's some scary compromise. DTNO, bi-monthly means both. Okay, good. I mean, specifically, it's every other month. It's not two updates a month. yeah, and Dave Burns is saying my parents hate them. Sorry, I kind of got off the thread catching up on these comments again. Al Spockley, the iPhone 12 subreddit is comically full of people complaining about screen tint and backing it up with some comparison photos. I mean, I don't want to take any glee in this. I got into it with an Asus rep. It was around the time the iPhone 10 launched and we were still doing the Newegg live show in studio. And I was just like, well, I mean, the reason why iPhones are so expensive and why Apple can charge $1,000 for a phone is because, you know, they're picking the most premium components. And you're like, no, the scores are the same as any other OLED. They're getting them from but they're binning. They're really making sure that the quality assurance, blah, 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 blah. No, we know that's not true. We know that this is kind of a silicon lottery on every single component, and some devices are going to be better than others. And the QA hopefully works out in your favor. The one thing I'll give Apple is if you're in the United States and in a couple other select regions, it might be easier to swap your phone out if there is a component issue. But iPhone OLEDs, Samsung OLEDs, OnePlus OLEDs, we've kind of reached parity and we're driving them so aggressively that issues are going to be issues are going to be issues. And no one seems to have a magic cure for those issues. Sorry, I got to catch up. We're going to wrap up a few more comments here. Aditi Anil saying the G8 is better than the iPhone 12 Pro. Yeah. Especially if you have nice headphones. Although I will have a video out soon on Periodic Audio. I didn't know if I was under embargo or anything for this, but they have a cute little USB-C DAC, and I've been so burnt out on testing these like USB-C adapters that I was kind of interested in what they had. So that video will be out probably on Friday, talking about how to add a good headphone jack to a phone that doesn't have it. Oh, see, Gary the Fireman, and this is totally something my wife would agree with too. In lieu of swapping my SIM from my 4XL to my 2XL, my iPhone 8 Plus has been a huge help in the mask era. So, couple things on that, and then we'll wrap up this show. My wife would totally agree. Her work phone is an iPhone 8, the smaller iPhone 8. And I think she's going to be due like a work upgrade, and I think they're just going to swap her to an iPhone SE. And so she's already familiar with the phone. The camera's going to get a teeny little bit better. Like nothing's going to change. Her battery life will probably go down. But yeah, so she's excited about that. She doesn't want to give up Touch ID. I'm telling you, from using the iPhone SE, the 2020 iPhone SE, it is so much nicer if you don't have an Apple Watch. Or even if you do have an Apple Watch and you really want to reference something on the phone, fingerprint is so much better. So I want to give Apple some kudos that they're going to start linking. They're going to start using Bluetooth connected devices as a security key to help the unlock process if you're wearing a mask and the face scanning isn't working. Now, what do we know about that? That's basically just the Bluetooth authentication process that we've got on Android. Something tells me Apple's going to make this sound fancier, like, oh, but it only works if you've got AirPods or an Apple Watch. So we're about security. Whatever, it's Bluetooth. You can already do that on Androids. So at least if you're kind of carting around a phone with face scanning, like if you've got your Pixel 4 XL and you don't have access to a fingerprint scanner, if you have any ability to pair some headphones or a smartwatch or even just any other kind of Bluetooth connected accessory, you can go into your security settings and say, hey, whenever this is connected, you can trust that I have the phone, or at least the phone is within 30 feet of me. Go ahead and unlock and bypass my lock screen. And that's a really handy feature. I lived out of that when I had my Pixel 4. I still have my Pixel 4 XL right here. When I was really using my Pixel 4 XL with my SIM card in it, I'm always wearing a smartwatch. It's me. So as long as you see the smartwatch connected, you can go ahead and unlock that screen. But again, short story, incredibly long, fingerprint sensor is always better. Oh, but it's so convenient. Whenever I want to unlock my phone, I have to handle the phone and then tilt it and then get it to look at me in a very particular way so that it scans. And then I have to swipe past some kind of additional lock screen. And, you know, like I have to give it all of my tactile and visual attention just to open it. And it's so convenient. JJ4884, what smartwatch are you using right now? So I am wrapping up a review on the Amazfit GTR2E, a less expensive fitness tracker, from Amazfit. This is my first Amazfit, and it's a solid little fitness tracker, but we just got, sort of a polish update on the TicWatch Pro 3, and it has been running a lot smoother. Especially on the sort of tap, interactions where when the low power display, I can't bend my arm enough to show you this on camera. When the low power display is up, there was kind of an intermittent lag when you would tap the screen to get the OLED to show, and that's gone. So we still need a lot more work on applets, but even without the Google update for performance, the TicWatch hardware, because this is now the more powerful processor for a smartwatch, and the little bit of a polish update that Mobvoi put out, this is now one of the most fluid watches for scanning through notifications. It still gets a bit choppy when you're firing up certain applets, but this is Wear OS on a totally different level. So if you've been using Fossils or you've been using the older generation of TicWatches, night and day. This is now a much more fluid and responsive. I mean, it still falls short of an Apple Watch. My Series 4 is definitely a more fluid experience than Wear OS, but Mobvoi has polished up Wear OS and is driving it with enough horsepower that this is much, much nicer. So I'm kind of back on this just to kind of do a longer term, you know, we got an update, whoa, kind of a video, but it's kind of brought me back to sort of loving my TicWatch again. And I've been a fan because of these low power displays that now I've got a more fluid watch that genuinely runs for about 3 days on a charge, which is rad. It's just really nice. Ooh, McCorcoran, great question. I've been trying to decide between the TicWatch Pro 3 or the Fitbit Versa 3. Ooh, that actually is kind of a fun showdown. Because again, it's very much, do you want the more communicative and smartwatchy features, or do you want the better fitness tracking features? And there's no good answer between that. I definitely side more on computer on my wrist, but from using the Amazfit, man, that thing on sort of moderate use, like my kind of use, genuinely lasting for over 10 days on a battery charge. Like from the last time I charged it up, where am I at? It's now down to 23% by forcing the always on display. And I want to say that has been about 10 days since I pulled it off the charger. That's kind of huge. So anyway, more to come as we talk about wearables, some fitness tracking, because I got to get my soggy midsection back in shape. I've been doing okay on like, you know, push-ups and calisthenics, but I got to up my cardio. And then we'll have a lot more to say on some audio tech coming. I got a new router. It may be borked on this stream, so that sucks. But the other features on this router have been really exciting to talk about. So I'm going to do some other testing to see if it's my side or Spectrum side, because Spectrum internet is garbage. I'm going to be getting a really cool 2-in-1 professional grade computing slate. I'm missing something else. Some audio tech from Periodic Audio. Camera, that's it. I'm packaging up the Sony a7S III to send it back to Sony. So there's going to be a video out on that. I've got like 7 videos in the pipeline right now, in varying degrees of completion. So there's going to be some fun stuff to talk about. I'm really excited because it's not just like, here's another video about the Galaxy S21. Please give me views, even though the SEO tanked. Now, we got to talk about more. And we got to kind of make this more of a lifestyle. Our tech is a lifestyle, so let's do it. All right. Aditya Anil, some do you even lift, bro, guy? Not even close. No, I don't. I don't even lift. I've got 25-pound dumbbells that I curl with 3 times a week. It's not enough. So let's go ahead and kick this. I'm going to get one more drink of water here and wrap it all up. Folks, I got to say, as always, I always appreciate these conversations, jumping in to have these kinds of chats, especially going long because this podcast has gone crazy long. But following up on these stories, having kind of a measured approach to how we might handle disagreements, and then also coming to some sort of meeting of the minds on different ways that we can re-engage this conversation. I think it's more important than ever. There are so many high-profile techie things that are going to start hitting our family and friends, and in ways that they might not see coming. They're buzzwordy hashtags that we talk about all the time. If it's right to repair, if it's net neutrality, if it's broadband, if it's consumer protections, if it's online privacy, hashtag end Facebook, blah, 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 blah. Beyond the hashtag activism, this landscape can look really intimidating and really scary from someone who's just trying to genuinely use services to stay in touch with family, to get their work done, to collaborate with their coworkers. And, you know, on the side end, then all of a sudden, like, well, I was in this Teams meeting and now it's a political statement, what platform I'm choosing to try and organize my, you know, collaboration with coworkers. If we're not joining this conversation, then the conversation is going to be occupied by people that don't have our interests and genuinely probably know less than we do about this kind of stuff. So I'm not telling you how to act, and I'm not telling you what your opinion should be, but I genuinely appreciate those of you who share this kind of content online, but then also take the extra effort to make your stances known, that are active and participating in this conversation with your state and federal elected officials, the people that you vote for, or maybe you didn't vote for, but who have been chosen to represent you in your city, in your state, and, you know, at the highest tiers of government. If we don't make our voices heard, if we don't contribute to this conversation, as opposed to just complaining from the sidelines when things don't go our way, you know, what are we complaining about? We didn't care enough to join the conversation. We let other people choose for us. So it means more to have these types of interactions and these types of conversations when I know that, like, we're at least going to broach these topics with our family and friends. There's a tech empathy at play, and we can be good tech neighbors. We can care about our family's eyesight. We can care about our family's hearing. We can care about our family's mental health, and we can recognize probably faster than their doctors can when some of these trends might be a little troubling, or when some of this behavior might be getting out of their control. When you see a family member that's just constantly doom scrolling on news sites, and maybe we can help walk them back from the edge. So, as always, these conversations replenish me. This is why I love holding my podcast on a Monday, is because I kind of get refueled. I kind of get amped up to get through this next week of video production and commentary and podcasting. And I hope some of these conversations can serve to invigorate you. Especially as I'm sure we're all kind of exhausted by some of these conversations. I know. I'll bring up net neutrality and I can feel my own eyes roll. Oh, I'm talking about this again. So I'm glad to have so many people along for the ride. Thank you so much. So folks, as I always leave these off, I want you to have an amazing week. I want you to do awesome with your technology. I want you to be awesome with your technology. And I want to see everyone back here next week for another episode of the Monday Morning Tech Chat Show on the SGGQA podcast channel. Be safe. Take care. It's going to get crazier before it gets better. But we know this, and we know we can buckle down, and we know we can get through this. I'll catch you back here next week.
Recording voiceover, spoken word, is truly one of my favorite activities. My second favorite hobby is photography. Now, the smartphone might be making us deaf, but we can't deny the awesome power of the phone as a platform for photography and multimedia creation. If you've been looking to improve your mobile photog skills, if you want to produce more professional content, or you're just looking to take your family photos to the next level, I wrote a book to help you out with that. Take Better Photos, Smartphone Photography for Noobs is available on Amazon Kindle. Walking through the basic terminology of photography, covering the settings on your camera, discussing composition and inspiration, and I even include a long list of exercises and challenges to really hone your skills, all with some helpful example photos and diagrams. Search for Take Better Photos, Smartphone Photography for Noobs on Amazon, or use the quick link bit.ly/betterphotosbook to grab your copy today.